It was my privilege yesterday afternoon to deal with the biblical information, which I think addresses the question that we have been looking into. According to the 16th chapter of the Gospel according to Matthew, and I invite you to open your Bibles to it. According to the 16th chapter of the Gospel according to Matthew, Jesus found himself in the territory of Caesarea Philippi. That is outside the area where most Jews lived. It is among the people that were, most of them, Gentiles. And this is approximately 6 to 10 months before the crucifixion. Probably closer to 6 months than to 10. And in the territory of Caesarea Philippi, Jesus asked the disciple a question that is brought up in verse 13. When Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." In the original text, it's very powerfully underlined. It is the Christ, the Son of the God, you know. I mean, each time very solidly underlined. And Jesus is elated. He is elated. His answer shows it very much. Verse 17, Jesus answered him, "Blessed art thou, Simon, son of John. For flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." And then comes the famous statement about Peter and the rock. What is interesting in this particular passage? Two things. First, for the first time, we find among the apostles that we know of course, as recorded, a very clear, what we call, Christological statement. That is to say, the apostles express the conviction that Jesus is the Christ, the coming Messiah. We also discover, much more important in the context of what we are discussing here, and which I'm discussing in the morning in the auditorium, that Jesus does not attribute Peter's correct answer to a proper way of thinking. See, when Jesus asks the question, "Who do people say that I am?" and Peter tells him, "You are the Christ, the one, the Son of the living God," he doesn't tell him, "Right, Peter, you are correct. You finally came to the right conclusion. You have heard me preached for so many months, you have seen me performing miracles, we have discussed the testimony of the scriptures, and you have come to the right conclusion. I congratulate you, Peter, for that." No, he doesn't say that. He tells him, "Blessed art thou, Simon, son of John, for neither flesh and blood has revealed that to you." Flesh and blood in the scriptures mean weak, fragile human being. It has nothing to do with the muscles and the sinuses and blood. It means frail, fragile human being. "Blessed art thou, Simon, son of John, for neither flesh or blood has revealed that to you." Notice, "has revealed that to you, but my Father who is in heaven has revealed it to you." The reason I think this is important is that Jesus is telling us in this passage that the only solid Christian understanding of Jesus Christ ought to be built on revelation. That is the starting point. Revelation. The kind of Christological statement, that is to say, a statement regarding the person of Christ that Jesus approves of and that he can endorse. In fact, he shows how pleased he is with Peter's statement. Is a Christological statement, statements made about Christ that are built on revelation. This is why yesterday we went to the scriptures and we tried to find out what the scriptures have to tell us. And today we shall likewise ask Ellen White to tell us what the truth is regarding the person of Christ. Now, there can be divergent interpretations of what we read. I mentioned that yesterday afternoon already. And I think we need to try to understand each other, and in particular, show compassion and brotherly, friendly love toward each other. Because I have no reason to believe that those who do not agree with me are not as sincere on the topic as I am. I told you yesterday, I have not always held what I do hold today. At the beginning of my ministry, my opinion was that Jesus Christ did share the same propensities to sin that I do have, as far as his moral nature is concerned. But that looking at what I think is the biblical evidence, I came to a different position, which I explained to you yesterday afternoon. Now, what is important is that we try to stay away from what contemporary theology is trying to do, what contemporary writers about the person of Christ are trying to do. It is to come up with a Christology that goes from the ground up into heaven instead of coming from heaven down to this earth. That is to say, start with Jesus as a man and see how it is possible for him to be both God and man. And usually the conclusion is an interesting one. Jesus deserves to be called God, or deserves in a certain sense. He is regarded as God. Now, it's not Arianism, though it sounds like it, to a certain extent. Nor is it the teaching of Apollinarius, although it also comes close to it. But it is a theology from down under up. I am interested in a doctrine of Christ that comes from revelation, that is built on what the Lord has revealed to us in the Scriptures, and as a Seventh-day Adventist, enlightened and informed by what Ellen White has to say on the subject. And I have no qualms and no apologies to offer on that particular point. I would like us, therefore, before we move on, before we go and read some statements from Ellen White, I would like to remind you briefly of what we found, yesterday afternoon. There is very little doubt in the Scriptures, no doubt at all, that Jesus Christ was a real human being. He was perceived by those who surrounded him as a human being. Now please, do not use the term Son of Man as evidence that he was human. Huh? Be careful about that. Sometimes I meet some of my students who tell me Son of Man is the proof that he was human, and the Son of God the evidence that he is divine. Very risky, very risky. Because Son of God, to begin with, is applied to other beings than Jesus in the Scriptures. Angels and even human beings are referred to as Son of God now and then. Besides, the term Son of Man, although it may strike us as underlining the humanity of Jesus, if you look at it very closely, you discover this. It is found approximately 80 times in the Gospels. And with one single exception, it's on the lips of Jesus. In other words, it was his favorite self-description title, Son of Man. And if you make a compilation, it's not difficult to make a list of those. Pick up a concordance, as I told you this morning in the auditorium. Pick up an exhaustive concordance and make the list. And go through that. There are worse ways of spending Sabbath afternoon than doing that, I can assure you. Pick up a concordance, make a list of the passages, and read them, and you will discover to your dismay that while at times Son of Man underlines the earthly dimension in Jesus, like the Son of Man has no place where to lay his head, that's very clearly reference to his humanity. There are many passages where Son of Man is used with divine connotations. Like you will see the Son of Man coming back on the cross of heaven with his angels. Time and again, so be careful. We know that Jesus Christ was really human on the basis of some of the things we saw yesterday afternoon. That we do know. We also know that if he was human, he was at one at the same time, both divine and human. How this is possible, I do not know, brothers and sisters, but it is what the Scriptures tell us, and that's what I'm concerned about. I want to find out what the Scriptures have to tell us, because as I mentioned this morning in another series of meetings, this is the Word of God, where prophets, guided by the Spirit, share under inspiration what God has revealed to them. I believe He's God and man because that's what the Scriptures tell us. Let's be very careful about what is logic. Logical. I mean, we Westerners are very fond of that which is logical. We saw that yesterday. But I also know that if Jesus Christ became man and was fully God and fully man, I am bound to ask myself the question, what kind of humanity was His? Especially since the Scriptures, without hesitation, tell us that He is the second Adam. He's not the second Moses. He's not the second Nehemiah. And certainly not the second Dederon. He is the second Adam. And to substantiate that, as I showed you yesterday afternoon, there are two groups of passages apparently in contradiction, which is not infrequent in the Scriptures because of the Semitic way of thinking, which is a dialectical way, a paradoxical way. And I gave you a few examples of that yesterday afternoon also. We covered a lot of ground yesterday afternoon. Sounds like it, huh? But the Scriptures tell us, there's quite a number of biblical passages who tell us that God sent His Son in the likeness of men. He sent His Son in the likeness of sinful flesh. He likewise partook of the same flesh and blood as we do. He was in every respect like unto His brethren in order to be a faithful high priest. We saw those passages and I told you, I can understand why some of my brothers and sisters, looking at those statements, come to the conclusion that Jesus Christ was exactly like as we are. I asked you yesterday afternoon, if you remember, let's play the game, that we are Muslims. And we have never heard about Christ. Let's try to forget what we know about Christ, which is very difficult. But I mean, that's the exercise. I'm trying to keep you awake on an afternoon there. I mean, let's look at those passages. How would Muslims look at those statements? He sent His Son in the likeness of sinful flesh, in the likeness of men. He likewise partook of the same. You would draw the conclusion that He's like we are. And that's what I did believe. And I do understand why some among us hold that particular view. And then there's the other group of passages, which we cannot deny because both are in the Scriptures, which tell us that Jesus knew no sin. That in Him there is no sin. And if we care at all about what the Scriptures tell us about sin, we notice that sin in the Scriptures is, of course, transgression of the law, the wrong choice. But it is more than that. Sin is also a state and a condition in which we are born, as Paul tells us in Romans 7. It is not a cop-out. It were, if you and I use that argument, I do not do the good thing I want to do, and I do the evil I do not want to do. So if I do what I do not want to do, and can't do what I would like to do, it's not I who do it, but it is sin within me. Oh, that's a nice cop-out, you know. Not a cop-out, it's written under inspiration. It is the truth. Sin is in me, not just as an act, but before it comes out as an act, it's already a principle there. Inherited tendencies to sin, we said. That is not the whole picture of sin, but it is one expression of sin, which is the one that we are interested in here in this series. Those irresistible tendencies to sin apart from Christ with which we are born, with which we come into this world. So, if Jesus can be presented also as in Him there is no sin, from that perspective, He knew no sin. And Satan has nothing in me, not just no power over me, but Satan has nothing in me. We are bound to come to the conclusion that he's different from what we are. And I have been suggesting that that difference lies in the fact that being the second Adam, he had to have at least something in common with Adam. He suffered the consequences of Adam's sin in all areas. His nature was a fallen nature. Let me insist on that. Fallen, F-A-L-L-E-N, fallen nature. In all respect, like as we are, except in the area of propensities to sin. And I did not try to explain it. I mean, who can explain how the everlastingly preexistent divine word became flesh and was born and had to learn to walk and to talk and to write? I mean, who can explain that? As Ellen White says, we are faced with an unfathomable mystery. Let me remind you the meaning of mystery in the Scriptures. Huh? Mystery does not mean in the Scriptures something we cannot understand. No, that's not the meaning in Scriptures. If you want to ask me the question, I'll show it to you on the blackboard on the basis of the root and the use of the term. Mystery means something that we know only because we have been told about it. The mystery of iniquity. What is the mystery of iniquity? Something we cannot know and which we shall all of a sudden, I mean, we won't even recognize it? No. Mystery of iniquity is the mystery that we know about because we have been told about it and the others cannot recognize it because they don't have the same source of information or don't want it. We are unquestionably faced with an issue there that should not divide us. It should not. First of all, it's not a fundamental belief. And second, I have seen in my friends who do not share my view genuine evidences of authentic Christian experience. I mean, there is no doubt about that in my own experience. We ought to be able to live side by side with that as long as the church hasn't taken a specific stand on it. At least, and I think even beyond that, we should be able to live together. I would like us today to take a look at what the servant of the Lord has said. Now, the statements that I have put together are representative statements. There are many more, literally hundreds of statements. And I have nothing to brag about because I get my pay to study the Scriptures and the writings of the servant of the Lord. Nothing to brag about that I was able to come up with a much, much, much longer collection than what I'll be presenting to you here. But I want you to look at that and try to understand what she is saying. And if we do not agree, let's not fight about words and try to interpret words in a way different from what they say in the context. Let's be careful about that. And if we still need to disagree, let's at least disagree on the basis of what the Scriptures tell us. Or, if we can, some clear statements from the inspired pen. So I would like to have a few volunteers to help me. John, would you hand those out? Would you, brother, be kind enough to go down the group here and hand them out this way? I'll help the other end. Okay. And let us begin. We may not read them all in extenso, but I would like to read, starting with the first one, which tells us, the first group, the mystery that we are faced with, that we should remember. In contemplating the incarnation of Christ in humanity, we stand baffled before an unfathomable mystery that the human mind cannot comprehend. So in other words, let's not claim that we know the last word about it. And let's limit ourselves to that which has been revealed. That which has been revealed is for us and our children. And that which has not been revealed is for the Lord Himself. That's what He tells us as early as Deuteronomy. Remember, as early as the first set of books in the Scriptures. But let's make sure that we take advantage of that which has been revealed. The humanity of the Son of God is everything to us. Do you hear that? It is the golden chain that binds our souls to Christ and through Christ to God. This is to be our study. I have had two of you yesterday who after the meeting came up to me and told me, isn't it a little sacrilegious what you are attempting to do? I mean, why don't you just leave Jesus alone? And you seem to be trying to probe into his personality. I said, no, I think we should be encouraged to do so, because Seventh-day Adventism is Jesus Christ. Christianity is Christ. Not Ten Commandments or 27 fundamental beliefs. They are very important. But the one non-negotiable dimension is the person of Jesus Christ. And Ellen White says, it should be our study. She says it. I read it here. This is to be our study. Elsewhere she says, if you want a topic that will deeply reward you, study the person of Jesus Christ. I have been, in all humility, I have been richly rewarded in learning to know who Jesus Christ is. And I know why I am a Seventh-day Adventist. Let me tell you. Christ was a real man. Next statement. From all eternity, Christ was united with the Father. And when he took upon himself human nature, he was still one with God. This is the same vocabulary as in the Scriptures. Do you remember yesterday afternoon, Philippians 2, verses 5 and following? He took upon himself the form of man. He took upon, and I told you yesterday afternoon that Jesus did not go through a metamorphosis. He did not change himself into a human being. He remained God, according to the Scriptures. He remained God and took upon himself, added unto himself, the human nature. The same vocabulary we find here. When he took upon himself human nature, he was still one with God. By his obedience to all the commandments of God, Christ wrought out a redemption for man. This was not done by going out of himself to another. You know what I admire about Ellen White? She's tackling one of the most difficult and complex issues in Christian thinking, the person of Christ. And she's not theologically trained. Thank God for it, by the way.
Amen.
And she does not try to play the theologian. Thank God again, you know. She does not try to play the theologian. But she's trying to explain in a grassroots, rank and file term what she sees, what she understands. And sometimes it is difficult. But she has told us several times that while she does not want to use cheap words to develop the plan of salvation, and she's eagerly looking for words to express what she has seen, the Spirit comes to her and helps her. And it is amazing the way she goes about it. We should listen. We really should, because it is the same vein of inspiration as we find in the Scriptures, the same vein of inspiration. Here we read, this was not done by going out of himself to another, but by taking humanity into himself. Christ took human nature that men might be one with him as he is one with the Father. Now, I mean, I could have given you 200 additional passages saying the same thing. That is to say, in different ways, that Jesus was God, took human nature, and was still God while he was on earth. Was both God and man. I simply wanted to show you that we have here the same teaching as in the Scriptures. Now, I would like you to read some statements that describe the human condition, as we did yesterday afternoon. Since Jesus Christ became human, we need to try to find out what human nature is. And here she tells us a few interesting things. Our hearts are naturally depraved. What does naturally mean? Born that way, by nature. It's not something which we acquire. Our hearts are naturally depraved. Does that remind you of what we saw yesterday afternoon? I could have added if you had wanted to. I mean, we did not exhaust the Scriptures yesterday. My students know very well at the seminary that I have no claim to exhaust what the Bible says on any particular topic. I simply show you the direction in which the Scriptures or the servant of the Lord are going, and we do not exhaust that topic, but I could have mentioned yesterday afternoon the famous passage of Ephesians 2, where the inspired apostle says, we are by nature, remember what? Children of wrath. By nature. What does it mean, children of wrath? Rightly deserving the wrath of God on our behavior. By nature. Born that way. Ellen White adds, by nature the heart is evil. Next statement. Selfishness is inwrought in our very being. It has come to us as an inheritance and has been cherished by many as a precious treasure instead of trying to get rid of it. Self-centeredness, that's the problem, you see. That is the basic foundational expression of our sinfulness. Self-centeredness, selfishness. Selfishness is inwrought in our very being. It has come to us as an inheritance. And then she tells us how it happened there in Adam's case. The result of the eating of the tree of knowledge of good and evil is manifest in every man's experience. There is in his nature a bent to evil, a force which unaided he cannot resist. Now please, this is not Raoul Dederon saying. Raoul Dederon is simply the student of what the scriptures tell us, and then try to find out if my conclusions are right, and whenever I come to a bifurcation, is that an English word? Okay. Whenever I come to a bifurcation, I try to find out that there are several possible explanations, several possible solutions. I listen to the inspired word and see, hey, this is the right track, walk in it. I think it's a much safer way. It is impossible for man, writes Ellen White in 1895. It is impossible. You will be surprised to see how many of those statements come right after the 1888 Minneapolis General Conference session with the powerful testimony of Wagner and Jones. It is impossible for man in his own unaided strength to overcome the natural propensities to evil. Notice, we have natural propensities to evil. In other words, if Jesus is a man, he should have the natural propensities to evil. Don't forget it. And the sister won't hold it against me if I say that's not only true of man, but also of woman. Yeah? When we talk about man, we use it in a generic sense. Huh? I mean, listen how obvious it is. It is impossible for man or woman in their own unaided strength to overcome the natural propensities to evil. And besides the natural ones, then we have acquired ones. And thank God, by the power of the Spirit, they can be overcome. Thank God for it, you know. But they are there. They are natural to us. They are inherited, says Ellen White, the tendencies to self-centeredness. This is why, you see, in Christian thinking, when you speak in terms of propensities, it is implied toward evil. It's not said in so many words, but when in Christian thinking you describe the human nature and you talk about the moral side of the human being and you say there are propensities, those propensities, the natural ones, are toward evil. And as we noticed yesterday, apart from Christ, they are irresistible. Ellen White says there is in us a bent that we cannot, unaided, that we cannot resist. Yesterday we defined that. Were you with us? You were not. Well, I won't hold it against you because you say it with a smile. She wants me to define propensity. Propensity is a combined Latin term, two Latin words together, which means a leaning toward. A leaning toward, a tendency. And let me assure you, it is very artificial to try to distinguish propensities and tendencies and leaning toward. It may serve the cause in some fine arguing, but even theologians abstain from it, understanding that those are interchangeable terms. The difference is, there is a difference between natural propensities and acquired propensities. That's true. There is a difference there between propensities that we are born with and propensities which we acquire. That is correct. But propensities are tendencies toward, and in theological thinking, understood as irresistible. Or as Ellen White says, apart from God's help, we cannot resist. Let's go to, or maybe we should go to the bottom of the page there. It was possible for Adam before the fall to form a righteous character by obedience to God's law, but he failed to do this. And because of Adam's sin, our natures are fallen. Let's never forget that. We are fallen. And Jesus took a fallen human nature. Since we are sinful, unholy, we cannot perfectly obey the holy law. We have no righteousness of our own with which to meet the claims of the law. Have you noticed? We are sinful. Not to be confused with sinners. We are not. When we are born into this world, we are not sinners. We are not guilty of Adam's sin, as we discussed yesterday afternoon. But we are born as part of the consequences of Adam's sin. We are born with tendencies to sin. That is to say, we are in sin. We are sinful. Sin has not yet taken its form. Has not had the occasion of leading us to transgress the law. We become guilty when we transgress God's will. Now, don't ask me what happens to two children who die before they commit a sin. I'll tell you frankly what the answer is. I do not know. And you would be surprised at the number of things I do not know. You would discover that very rapidly. I do not know because I refuse to speculate. I listen to, and if it is a problem for me, I can rely upon the fact that God is righteous, holy and fair, more compassionate than I am. And if I am concerned about it, I'm sure he will find a solution. So I trust him, and I wait until then. But I will not start an offshoot on that basis, I can assure you. On the next page, the servant of the Lord writes, through sin, now notice what is happening. Through sin, the whole human organism is deranged. The mind is perverted. The imagination corrupted. You would be surprised how often she uses the term corrupt, corrupted, corruption. It is a term that comes in continuously, meaning deranged, no longer what it was at the beginning. Corrupted. Continuously it comes back under the inspired pen. Sin has degraded the faculties of the soul. Temptation from without find an answering chord within the heart, and the feet turn imperceptibly toward evil. Anybody prepared to challenge that? Is your experience so very different from mine? The problem with temptation is not so much what I face outside, it's what's going on inside. And if there were not an answering chord inside, it would have no effect upon me. Frankly, we shall go back to that. Starting tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, and Friday, when we shall look at the temptations of Christ. Because a major problem, at least in the eyes of some, with what Raoul Dederon is saying here, is that if Jesus Christ did not have the tendencies to sin, how could he be tempted? Huh? How could he be? And not only that, but I have another card there in the sleeve that I would like to come up. Even if you are able to explain to me how he could be tempted without having the tendencies to sin, how can he be my example in all things if he did not have the propensities to sin, which I do have? How can it be said in Hebrews 4 that he was tempted in all things like as we are, yet without sinning? Raoul Dederon is not planning to put that under the carpet, believe me. No. I want to look into that one step at a time, and we shall look at it together and I shall listen to what you have to say about it. But please, if you don't agree, do it on a biblical basis. No speculation, or at least as little of it as possible. Because it's just the fact that we talk, we are speculating. Just the fact that we talk. Let's move on here. Now we move to a third group of passages. Have you noticed we have seen two things, just as in the scriptures? First, that Jesus Christ became a human being. Second, we have seen that the human nature is corrupted, degraded. So the conclusion that you would draw is, since Jesus Christ became human, he took that degraded human nature, fallen human nature, right? Let's take a look at those passages, if you please. I read, "In taking upon himself man's nature in its fallen condition, Christ was subject to the infirmities and the weaknesses by which man is encompassed." Have you noticed? He took man's nature in its fallen condition. Let's never forget that. In spite of what I have heard, my, have I heard atrocious things about questions on doctrine. I still remember, I started in the ministry in 1947, as you heard in the auditorium. And when the questions on doctrine came out in 1952-53, it was a great blessing. Unfortunately, there were a few pages there, a few tens of pages there, that dealt with the nature of Christ in what I think is not exactly what the Bible says, giving to Christ a pre-fall nature. That's correct. But, I mean, the rest of the book is extremely helpful. And I remember how it helped me in my ministry. In those days, whatever was published by the Review and Herald was close to gospel word, you know. Gospel word. In those days, I read every line of the ministry magazine with great interest and desire to implement it. And I don't feel sorry for it, to tell you the truth. I spent 7 years in the pastoral ministry and I enjoyed them. But here what I read is that Jesus took man in his fallen condition. Next statement. Christ who knew not the least taint of sin or defilement. Christ who knew not the least taint of sin or defilement took our nature in its deteriorated condition. Now what is that deteriorated condition? If it is not in the likeness of man, in the likeness of sinful flesh, in every respect like unto his brethren. Jesus accepted humanity when the race had been weakened by 4,000 years of sin. And let me repeat what I have said. There are scores of other passages who convey the same message. This is not just an accidental statement on the part of Ellen White. She tells us, as the scriptures do, that the human nature that Jesus took was fallen human nature. In his fallen condition, deteriorated by 4,000 years of sin, weakened over against Adam, of course, weakened by 4,000 years of sin. For 4,000 years, the race had been decreasing in physical strength, in mental power, and in moral worth. And Christ took upon him the infirmities of degenerate humanity. Only thus could he rescue man from the lowest depths of his degradation. Have you noticed how time and again she speaks about picking up our infirmities? What is an infirmity? How would you describe an infirmity? That's it. A liability, a disability, something that is not in our favor. Over against, let's not prolong that, but let's go on. He took upon himself fallen, suffering human nature, degraded and defiled by sin. Very clear. And then she adds, she also says, and we are still in the same period of her ministry. Christ had not taken on him even the nature of angels, but humanity, perfectly identical with our own nature. Perfectly identical with our own nature. You notice that? Perfectly identical with our own nature. Except, she says, without the taint of sin. Except without the taint of sin. And if you remember, just three or four quotations earlier, Christ who knew not the least taint of sin. Here she says it again. Perfectly identical with our own nature, except without the taint of sin. In him, says Ellen White, was no guile or sinfulness. He was ever pure and undefiled, yet he took upon him our sinful nature. Oh, my! Now that's very clear, huh? He took upon him our sinful nature, ever undefiled, ever pure, but he took our sinful... Now, if Sister White were around, I think I would ask her politely a question. Can you tell me how it is possible for Jesus to take our fallen, defiled, corrupted nature without a taint of sin? I mean, how can that be? Notice what follows. He took upon his sinless nature our sinful nature. I don't think we can find stronger passages than that along the first group of statements which we found in the scriptures. He took upon his sinless nature our sinful nature, that he might know how to succor. How do we say that? Succor. Well, you know what I mean, huh? I'm learning English, and succor has for me a different meaning. You know? that he might know how to succor those that are tempted. You don't know it, but when you say succor, you know, you are using a Latin word, which means to come to the help of. That's what the word means in Latin. I suppose the same thing in English. He was to take his position at the head of humanity by taking the nature but not the sinfulness of man. Oh, now, Sister White, I'm really confused. Maybe you are not, Sister White. But to tell you the truth, I am confused. And it is all in those years after Minneapolis in the 90s, 1901, 05. All those texts coming together at that particular time. Now tell me, Sister White, now I'm faced with a real problem here. And I'll give you a chance to ask questions as we did yesterday when we are through here. Now notice what we read here. She says, he was to take his position at the head of humanity by taking the sinful nature, we saw in a previous statement, taking the nature, the sinful nature of man, but not its sinfulness. Now tell me, Sister White, how can you take the sinful nature without its sinfulness?
Sinfulness has to be.
Now, you know, I mean, I told you a moment ago, she is struggling. She's not a theologian. And theologians have not been able to do better than that anyway. But I mean, she's struggling. She's trying to explain in words that people can understand, and she will explain it to us. But I want you to be aware of what is going on. She obviously is facing the same two groups, two sets of statements in Revelation that we found in the scriptures, coming in the likeness of sinful men. And in him there is no sin. How can he take the sinful nature? But she says, without its sinfulness. And there are other passages who say the same thing. Without the sinfulness. How is that possible? Well, let me read to you what she said. The humanity of Christ is called that holy thing. He is a brother in our infirmities. Again, infirmities. But not in possessing like passions. Oh, that is interesting. There's a difference there. Some people say, no difference. She said, but not having like passions. Now tell me, what is a passion? When I use the word passion, when you use the word passion, what comes to your mind? Usually lust. And interestingly enough, in most instances, sexual lust. That's what passion is. Well, let me tell you, brothers and sisters, passion is a very neutral word. It simply means a strong urge. And it can be used for good or used for bad. In fact, in the book Patriarchs and Prophets, describing Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, I remember now, it strikes me as I'm talking to you, Ellen White says that in the Garden of Eden, Adam kept his appetite under the control of passion, his appetite and passions under the control of reason. Now, how could Adam have passions in the Garden of Eden before the fall if passion doesn't simply mean a strong urge? You know, we are born with urges, with passions. And I tell you, I'm glad it is so. I'm glad I'm not a cooked noodle that needs to be pulled in order to move on. I'm glad that I have been created with urges. I have an urge for good food, and I'm not embarrassed about it. And I can fulfill it as long as I do it in harmony with God's will. There's no problem there. I have a passion for female companionship. And no problem there as long as I fulfill it in harmony with God's will. And if you knew my wife, you would understand why I'm fulfilled. But I mean, a passion in itself is not bad. It depends on what kind of passion is referred to. And this is why Ellen White is saying here, and she says it many times, Ellen White is saying here, he is a brother in our infirmities. He has the same infirmities that he has. But not in possessing like passions, as the sinless one, his nature recoiled from evil. He was unsullied with corruption. Here it comes again, you know. Corruption, unsullied with corruption, a stranger to sin. Yet he prayed, and that often, with strong crying and tears. He prayed for his disciples and for himself, thus identifying himself with our needs, our weaknesses, our failings, which are so common with humanity. He was a mighty petitioner, not possessing the passions of our human fallen nature. Did not have those, she says. Not have those. But compassed with like infirmities. Tempted in all points, even as we are, Jesus endured agony which required help and support from his Father. He took upon himself human nature and was tempted in all points as human nature is tempted. He could have sinned. He could have fallen. But not for one moment was there in him an evil propensity. That is interesting. Not only did he not have like passions, his passions were not the same as ours. There's a difference there. And here comes another one. Not for one moment was there in him an evil propensity, which is also a letter written in the 1890s. In fact, in 95 is the letter sent to an evangelist, an American evangelist in Australia by the name of Baker. And then the following three paragraphs make a very powerful comparison between Adam and Christ. Christ as the second Adam. We talked about that yesterday morning and yesterday afternoon, and she tells us how difficult it is to compare Christ to Adam, except the second Adam to the first, except that he was fighting against tremendous odds. That Adam was in a much more favorable condition than what Christ was. We could, for instance, say here, look here, the second of those three paragraphs. When Adam was assailed by the tempter in Eden, he was without the taint of sin. Here we have it again. Without the taint. Adam was without the taint of sin. Do you remember our reading that Jesus Christ was without the taint of sin? In the middle of page 2. In the middle of page 2 there. The quotation which starts, he had not taken on. You see in the middle of page 2, he had not taken on him. Alright. He had not taken on him. The middle of page 2. He had not taken on him even the nature of angels, but humanity, perfectly identical with our own nature, except without the taint of sin. And now in the quotation we are reading, the middle of page 3, Christ in the wilderness of temptation stood in Adam's place, and the previous statement reads that Adam in Eden was without the taint of sin. You see the similarity between the first and the second Adam there. He stood in the strength of his perfection before God. All the organs and faculties of his being were equally developed and harmoniously balanced. Christ in the wilderness of temptation stood in Adam's place. To bear the test, Adam failed to endure. Here Christ overcame in the sinner's behalf 4,000 years after Adam turned his back upon the light of his home. Separated from the presence of God, the human family had been departing every successive generation farther from the original purity, wisdom and knowledge which Adam possessed in Eden. The comparison between the first and the second Adam is certainly not to the advantage of Jesus Christ. And then she uses the comparison again. And we are still dealing with those same years. Before the turn of the century there, Christ is called the second Adam. In purity and holiness, connected with God and beloved by God, he began where the first Adam began. Now, I will not exploit this passage. He began where the first Adam began to mean that he had the same nature. Because the text is not against it by a long shot. But she's talking about temptation in the ministry of Jesus Christ. And then she adds, there were no corrupt principles in the first Adam, no corrupt propensities or tendencies to evil. The divine nature, going back to Christ, the divine nature combined with the human made him capable of yielding to Satan's temptation. Here the test to Christ was far greater than that of Adam and Eve. For Christ took our nature, fallen but not corrupted, and would not be corrupted unless he received the words of Satan in the place of the words of God. Not corrupted, not the slightest stain of sin, never for one moment was there in him an evil propensity. That is the similarity between Christ and Adam there. The Spirit was given him without measure, for his mission on earth demanded this. Christ's life represents a perfect manhood, just that which you may be he was in human nature. He took our infirmities. And then two or three statements that I think we can end up with before I summarize and give you a chance to ask some questions. Be careful, writes Ellen White in 1895. Be careful, exceedingly careful, as to how you dwell upon the human nature of Christ. Do not set him before the people as a man with the propensities of sin. Do not do that, she says. She's writing to Baker. It's a long letter in which she deals with the human nature of Christ, among other things. Do not set him before the people as a man with the propensities of sin. He is the second Adam. You notice how she associates the two? It's not Dedron's saying. She associates both. The first Adam was created a pure, sinless being, without a taint of sin. We have it again. He was in the image of God. He could fall, and he did fall through transgressing. Because of sin, his posterity was born with inherent propensities of disobedience. But Jesus Christ was the only begotten Son of God. He took upon himself human nature and was tempted in all points as human nature is tempted. He could have sinned, he could have fallen, but not for one moment was there in him an evil propensity. It's very much the second Adam in that area. He was assailed with temptations in the wilderness, as Adam was assailed with temptations in Eden. And we are faced with a strange dilemma that we will have to address. How can she, Ellen White, not Ronald Edwin, I do the same thing, but who am I? But how can she, in the same breath, the same paragraph, I don't need to collate passages. How can she, in the same breath, say, never for one moment was there in him an evil propensity, yet he was tempted in all things like as we are and without sinning. How can she say that? There is an explanation. And at least I think there is one. And I'll share it with you as we move on. Avoid, does she say in the same letter, avoid every question in relation to the humanity of Christ which is liable to be misunderstood. Now that's something that I need to hear as a teacher. Avoid every question in relation to... She doesn't mean question which you ask. She means issues. Avoid every issue in relation to the humanity of Christ which is liable to be misunderstood. When you talk about it, make sure that you are not misunderstood, she says. Truth lies close to the track of presumption. And Raoul, everyone needs to hear that. Truth lies close to the track of presumption. In treating upon the humanity of Christ, you need to guard strenuously every assertion, lest your words be taken to mean more than they imply, and thus you lose or you dim the clear perception of his humanity as combined with divinity. His birth was a miracle of God. Never in any way leave the slightest impression upon human minds that a taint of or inclination to corruption rested upon Christ, or that he in any way yielded to corruption. Now the last statement, part of the same letter, talking about Christ, she says he was tempted in all points, like as man is tempted. Yet he is called that holy thing. It is a mystery that is left unexplained to mortals, that Christ could be tempted in all points like as we are, and yet without sin. The incarnation of Christ has ever been and will ever remain a mystery. That which is revealed is for us and for our children. But let every human being be warned from the ground of making Christ altogether human, such as one of ourselves, for it cannot be, she says. I think we have a series of statements from Ellen White there dealing with the topic in which we find what we found yesterday in the Scriptures. Namely, one group of passages that seems definitely to tell us that God sent His Son in sinful flesh, although, as I mentioned later on yesterday afternoon, God sent in the likeness of sinful flesh, not sent Him in sinful flesh. Ellen White says, without the slightest hesitation, that God sent His Son in sinful flesh, that Jesus took our sinful nature. But then she adds, He took our sinful nature, but not its sinfulness. So how can you take the sinful nature without the sinfulness? She says, look, what I'm trying to say is that He had the same infirmities, the same casualties, the same consequences, but He did not have the same passions, and not for one moment was there in Him an evil propensity. He is the second Adam. He had to fight the fight where Adam had been conquered in order to overcome. Now, I'm not claiming that I have explained everything to everybody's satisfaction. And what I'm sharing with you is a result of years of reflection. And there have been questions in my mind all the way through, of course, which probably pop up in your own minds. And I shall be glad to hear them. If you have some questions, we shall proceed as we did yesterday, from one section to the other, if possible, alternating men and women. Any question on this side? Yes, sister. Oh, maybe I should take this again as I did yesterday, so that people hear the question.
I'd like to understand more fully what Ellen White exactly means when she's talking about sinful nature. Is it only physical? What do you think she means?
Were you with us yesterday afternoon? All right, so I do not need to repeat the whole thing. Sinful nature is a nature marred by sin. In other words, our intellectual faculties, our physical abilities, even our moral worth are affected by sin. It is a nature that is marred by sin. And that includes, of course, in the moral sphere, a bend toward sinfulness, toward sinning. Oh yeah, that's part of the sinful nature. It is a vocabulary that we are not very well used to, because it is not the vocabulary that we use on the street when we talk with friends. Because for us, Westerners, sinful would mean not just full of sin, but full of committing sin. But remember, sin in the scriptures is not just the action of sin, it's also the condition in which we are. So that sinfulness is the condition of sin in which we are. Not yet guilty until we do commit sin, but our whole human nature, all our abilities are affected by Adam's sin. I'm sorry, I'm moving in this section here. Yes. Oh, maybe. Well, let me go over there and give it to you. Could you come out there so it'd be easier?
There it is. If we are told that Christ came to cover Adam as well as ourselves, then he backed up, as it were, and took on Adam's nature before the fall. How do you explain that?
I would explain it this way. As I said yesterday and refer to it today, I would be very, very skeptical regarding the soundness of logics. It may sound logical to say that if Jesus Christ came as the second Adam, he should have the same nature as Adam before the fall. This is logical, but it is not what the scriptures tell us, nor is it what the servant of the Lord tells us. We ought to move from that which strikes us as rational to that which is revealed. And the scriptures tell us that God sent his Son in the likeness of sinful flesh. And the scriptures tell us, or Ellen White affirms again, that Jesus Christ took our infirmities, took our human nature in their fallen condition after 4,000 years of degradation, with the exception of the propensities to sin. And that's where he's closer to Adam than he is to what happened after the fall. Now, you're right on that point. In this area here, I'm sorry, we move from one. No lady in this area? All right, then let's start with you, sister.
Humanity has to go through the process of conversion to be right with God. Now Christ never had to go through that. So, how do you explain that?
I don't need to explain it. It's a fact. No. Let me ask you a question. Why do we need to go through conversion? Do you know why? Why? Because we sin. Because we do sin. And since Jesus Christ did not sin, he did not need to go through repentance and conversion, at least from what we know in the scriptures. Yeah. Well, the question is, why was he baptized? Do you remember what happened when he came to John the Baptist? Do you remember how enthusiastic John the Baptist was to baptize him? All right, let's do it. I'll add one soul to my monthly report. Is this how John the Baptist saw it? My, it'll add to my glory, you know, to baptize. No, he said, I baptize you? You should baptize me. That's what he meant. But Jesus said, let's do it so that God's righteousness be fulfilled. This is part of God's plan. So let's do it. In other words, he wanted to leave us without excuse. If he went through baptism, what excuse do we have, we who are sinners, not to accept baptism? Have you encountered people, haven't you, that do not want to be baptized? At times it's because they fear water. I do. I remember my own ministry, you know. But some people just have not understood that they are sinners. I mean, I'm not worse than Mrs. Smith or than Mr. Doe, you know. I don't want to baptize. In Jesus Christ's case, it was to function as an example. I'll give you a chance to ask the question. Yeah.
Please. You made a point at the first of the study in pointing out that our human nature involves our spiritual condition as well as our physical condition. But yet, when it comes to the subject of Christ, he is equated as our equal in the physical condition in which we are, but not in the spiritual condition in which we are. Therefore, the question that bugs me is, how could he be tempted if he had no propensity to sin? How could he be tempted as we are when we have a natural propensity to do the evil? Is this just like the incarnation? It's one of those mysteries that we will have to rest in faith on?
It is very kind of you to consider that it may be a mystery that we cannot address. And you are right. We probably would be safer by not trying to solve it. But I think we have enough elements in the scriptures to address it. And I would like to remind you, because you were awake while I was speaking here, I noticed that, and following carefully what I was saying. You know? You remember my saying that one of the questions that people have when I explain what I do explain is one of the questions that came up in my own mind when I went through the process, and which you expressed very clearly, that is to say, how could he be tempted if he did not have the propensities to sin that I do have? How is that possible? We'll come to that. I wish you would come tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, and we need to go one step at a time. Do you remember? I mean, I don't want to compare myself to the Lord Jesus, but I think he has taught me how to go about it. Remember several times the good Lord said to his disciples, I still have many things to tell you, but
you're not ready for them yet.
I think the Lord has taught me that, brother. He really has over the years.
One of our not so virtues is a lack of patience.
Thank you. But you know, You are as impetuous as Peter was, and that is a compliment. They made him general council president at the time. All right, let's go back to the group over there. Do we have somebody over there? Preferably a lady? No lady. All right, then let's go for a gentleman. All right?
You, brother, you have had your hands up for some time.
Yeah. 1 Peter 3:18, it says that Christ has once suffered for sins, the just for the unjust. How could he legally do that?
Well, allow me to give a very brief answer, because it is not exactly what we are looking at here. It has to do with the meaning of Christ's death on the cross. It is not without importance. I don't want to convey that impression, but I suppose there are some people who have questions about what I said. Do you remember how John the Baptist described Jesus when he pointed him to the disciples? Do you remember? This is the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world. And what do you think, what connotation did bring that about? I mean, what is there in the Jewish heritage that led John the Baptist to make a statement of that kind, you think? The sanctuary ritual sacrifices, where you came with a blameless sacrifice to represent the death of the coming Messiah. So it had to be a just, a righteous person for unjust people. And that is precisely what offended the Greeks so much, as I said yesterday afternoon, you see. They could not understand that this was an act of love on the part of God, and not certainly not an act of righteousness to accept that an innocent person pay for a guilty one. That was beyond their understanding.
Didn't he have to take our nature to do that?
Oh, he had to become human. Yeah. Well, he had to take our fallen nature, no doubt about that. In order to become human, he had to have a fallen nature. And in order to convince, you know what the Lord did? In order to convince us of the reality of his human nature, since he was the second Adam, couldn't he come down on earth, to earth, as Adam came? I mean, do you think Adam was created as a child? How would you describe Adam when he came out of the hands of the Creator? I'm not asking about measurements, but how do you think about it? A mature adult person. Jesus Christ as the second Adam could very easily have been brought into this world like the first Adam. But God did not do it. You see, we need crutches in our spiritual lives. And God wanted to convince us that he was a real, genuine human being, as we saw yesterday afternoon. And he had to take our fallen nature, but as Ellen White says, our sinful, fallen nature, but not its sinfulness.
Over here? Yes, a lady. Let me come to you. Speaking of baptism, okay?
Baptism. Christ said, of course, we must be born of the water and of the Spirit. But don't you think the reason he was baptized as an example to the human race, took care of people like the thief on the cross?
Well, I wasn't very clear, obviously, in what I said. Remember when I answered it in part, I said, so that we be without excuses for not being baptized, we who are sinners. He was an example. I think you are very correct. Yeah. All right. Now, this side here, a gentleman.
Yeah, one of your quotes that you used here out of Steps to Christ raised a question in my mind. It says at the very bottom, it was possible for Adam, before the fall, to form a righteous character by obedience to God's law. And I've always been under the impression that Adam's character was perfect anyway because he was created that way.
A good Western thinker. Good Western thinker rooted in Greek thinking. Very good. Excellent. You see, the problem with us, brother, influenced by Plato and Aristotle, the great philosophers, nobody has beaten them yet, outdone them in the Western world. But they have a few shortcomings from the biblical perspective. If something is perfect, it cannot be improved. Huh? In the Bible, that which is perfect is perfectible. In other words, if Adam had still been 1 year after his creation the same he was, he would not have grown. We grow in perfection. Up until we reach a certain point, because it is in moral growth that we grow in perfection. Huh? In perfection, when we grow, it is in the moral sphere. It has nothing to do with the physical. As much to do with the intellectual. But Adam, this is why Jesus also learned obedience through what he suffered. Although he was perfect and without sinfulness, he still had to grow learning obedience. And the same thing happened for the first Adam. Oh yeah, very much so. We are simply victimized by our Western education. We need to think in terms of what the scriptures tell us. On this side, a lady if possible? Yes.
I have a question. There's a controversy going on ever since Lucifer fell, that God had a law that could not be kept. And when Jesus came, he came with the idea that he could prove that man could, through God the Father, could keep that law and obey. Jesus had a sinful nature, that's true, but he never sinned. And Satan tried his best all Christ's life to get him to sin. If he had sinned once, we'd have been lost. And the 144,000 are going to be overcomers and prove, along with Jesus, that that law can be kept and that the controversy is ended and everyone's going to see that it was possible.
May I ask the nasty question that I asked a couple of times? Were you with us yesterday afternoon?
No,
you were not. Well, I can see that. Yesterday afternoon, I talked about the controversy. And that the issue at stake was, is God a fair God? A God who really loves us as he claims he does? Or is he a despot?
A sinful nature is not sin.
You're right.
The Holy
I think you're right. A sinful nature, it is sinful nature without the sinfulness, without sin. And as I also said, and we shall see that as we move on, that provision has been made to overcome sin. And sin is without excuse in our lives. No doubt about it. Back over there. Anybody? Yes, brother, come over, please. Come a little toward me so we save time.
There's a passage of Scripture that makes this whole thing beautifully clear to me. And I never hear it used in the discussion of the subject. And it's in the very simple language of John in chapter 1. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness could not comprehend it or overcome it. Now, many of these passages from Sister White describe the beauty of the light, the perfect righteousness of Christ. some of them describe the deformity and depravity of human nature, which is the darkness. But now when Jesus came and took our nature, the darkness was brought into contact with his light. And what happens when light and darkness come into contact? It's the light that wins out. And so sometimes when people say that if Jesus had taken fallen human nature, that would have made him a sinner, they're saying that the darkness would be more powerful than the light. But the truth is, and we all know, that light is greater than darkness.
Well, I don't know if you'll take it as a compliment, but you have the making of a theologian. All right? How about here? A lady, preferably. Yes.
I want to ask a question. Was Adam created with a perfect character or with perfect innocence and left to develop a character? Are babies born with perfect innocence and have to develop a character?
Well, let's make no comparison between the creation of Adam and that of babies. But Adam, it all depends on what we mean by innocent and a perfect character. Since a character is something that is progressively built up, a character is a sum total of the characteristics of my moral life that make it what it is. So it has to grow, the build-up of a character. In that sense, we can say that that Adam had to build up a character and grow. But to start with, he was innocent, which is not a biblical terminology. It is a Roman Catholic one, by the way. He was innocent in the sense that he had no experience of sin and no tendencies to sin. He had everything on his side to win. Yeah. Over here? Yes? Oh, yeah, you have been waiting for some time.
Adam did not have to sin in his state of holiness. Christ did not have to sin in his state of sinlessness. Why didn't Christ sin in his fallen nature? The inspiration tells us that Christ had intense inclination or propensity to do God's will. I delight to do thy will, O God. Thy law is within my heart.
Yeah, that's very, the reason. You are very correct. See, if Jesus Christ did not have propensities to evil, but propensities to good, as the first Adam had, that he was delighted in doing God's will. But can you imagine what it meant for him to be delighted in doing God's will in a world that was rebellious and rebelled against God and mocked him? He could not live very long. People had to get rid of that fellow who delighted to do God's will.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you would discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. American Christian Ministries is not a one-man band. It is an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.